Hello, this is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. My name's Brian Dwyer. With me, Lee Kelly. How are you, Lee?
Hi, Brian. I'm well, thank you.
I think Apollo Bay readers perhaps go north in the winter because you and I have been holding the fort for a while, haven't we?
And you're looking out the window. I couldn't understand why they would do that, Brian.
What have you been reading?
Well, it's actually perfect reading weather, really.
It is, isn't it? Yes.
And sometimes when you're looking out and trying to find the break in the weather to walk the dog, you think people come to Apollo Bay, some people, for this time of the year, for this experience
yes.
of the bracing sea air and sitting around by the fire reading. So I've been doing a bit of that. I'm actually reading a book at the moment that was given to me by a friend, Isabel Allende's The Japanese Lover. Isabel Allende she's been quite a prolific writer. She's originally born in Peru and grew up in Chile or something like that.
Mm.
And I think she lives in America. Now, she's actually really popular. But I read one of her books before and I wasn't all that keen, but I'm quite enjoying this one.
Is it The House of the Spirits or? There was one that was very popular.
Yeah, The House of the Spirits, her most popular one, but I don't think that's the one I read. But anyway, this one's really got me in. It's quite interesting. It's a very unusual setting. It's an old person's home in America telling this story from about a woman who lives there who's 73, but she's quite independent, and the relationship she builds with one of her carers. She actually employs her to come and work with her and file some of her memoirs and so on. So the story sort of works at two levels because there's a backstory about the carer and then there's the mystery of Alma and where she's been and what she's come from. I think that's a really interesting idea because, I mean, my mum was in a nursing home and you quite often realise that there are people there who have incredible stories, incredible lives that they've lived.
Yes.
You know, no one knows anything about it. It's sort of mysterious.
And when we're young, we make this terrible mistake of thinking that old people are not interesting.
The character who's a migrant with her own story, Irina, she really articulates that quite often about how there's this distaste for the old because of their slowness and their inability to recall things and stuff, but how she finds something really delightful about their willingness to talk about themselves and to get rid of all sort of subterfuge out of their lives. They just tell it like it is because they haven't got time to waste.
Is this the carer?
Yeah, yeah. So you hear from her point of view, she's got, you know, this life.
Is she the narrator?
It swaps a little bit because it's one of those ones where you have a different narrative perspective.
That's all the rage, isn't it, these days?
Well, it allows you to change to a different space, you know, and a different perspective. But, she does, toss around some of the ideas that are contemporary, but in telling the backstory of Alma, you also explore that the sort of trauma, the long-standing trauma that war can bring to people, you know, the separation of loved ones, the breaking of relationships and how, 50, 60 years later, that's still a dominant thing.
Such an interesting idea that, you know, the trauma that people carry with them.
Yeah. I just think it's brave to establish with that setting. Because it's not one that sort of would be necessarily sexy or appealing to people.
And it's a novel. It's not a memoir.
Novel.
She's a novelist. And has it got any of the magic realism in it?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. But not like we were talking about Marquez and stuff like that. It's just a little bit like her grandson's got this briefcase and it's passed down from his grandfather and it seems to have some magical properties. It makes him write better when he uses it. It's a story's writing in. You know, just little things like that, where you sort of take in the idea of the love of, you know, and the connection with a grandparent and connecting that somehow to success in your life.
Yeah. I think, was it you saying last week, quoting Tim Winton or somebody, well, have a look around. There's a lot of stuff that's hard to explain. As indeed there is in this book, which you recommended to me and which I'm returning to
Thank
you.
Thank you, Brian. You'll be crossed off the list of Everin Borrowers.
This is An Isolated Incident by Emily Maguire. It's an Australian novel, and the irony of the title is quite bitter, really, isn't it? Where to start about this? It has two narrative voices. It's about the response, the reaction to a murder in a small country town off the Hume Highway. And one of the narrative voices is the sister of the victim, and the other one is the sort of, you know, this almost all-knowing third person who follows the perspective of the young journalist who comes into town. But it's about the different ways of seeing what's happening. So interesting.
We touched on it last week when we were talking about crime, but it really is a novel you could, like, if people are looking for things for book clubs and things, it's a really good one to, because it's got that sort of drive to get through, find out what happens.
Yeah,
but there's also
thriller.
Lots of interesting things in it that you can stop and discuss.
Yes, and you can read it on those different levels. It is a thriller, but it's not really about who the villain is or anything. You know, that sort of resolved satisfactorily, but that's not really what the book's about.
No, I think that's one of the interesting things. Like I said last week, she said in it she was more interested in the victims than the crime and the detective and the sort of all that builds up afterwards. And I think that's really interesting because it's almost when you finally find out who committed the act, it's like an anticlimax, and it's just passed over very quickly because it's not the real story.
Yeah. Well, one of the many points that she develops in this is that we, as the general public, we kind of have an appetite for crime, but we're very callous about it. Like, you know, another story will pop up in a couple of days' time and we'll be all emotional about that. Like the people whom the sister has never met and doesn't know, who established a little shrine at the scene of the crime. Who the hell are these people and what are they on about?
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of a whole industry of grief, and she kind of, the sister Chris, resents it.
Yeah, and the bit where they have a march against violence for women, and they want her to take part, and she just sort of says, you know, well, who the hell are you? And, you know, I don't want to become your centrepiece for your issues. This is my sister.
Yeah. So it's politicised. It's manipulated by the press, the newsrooms of various organisations. And the journalist, May, she's conflicted within herself. She knows it's a tacky thing to do to harass the grief-stricken family, but it's her job, so she's going to do it. And she's a bit conflicted about that. That is kind of resolved when she eventually befriends the sister, the bereaved sister. But Chris, the sister, has her own conflicts too about all sorts of things. So look, there are a couple of really, really chilling themes that run through it. One is, it could be anybody who's done this. It could be the people I'm serving in the pub. It could be the people I'm talking to in the street. I mean, who's done this horrible, horrible crime? And because you don't know who's done it, you imagine it could be anybody. Yeah, no, and who can you trust?
Yeah, but I think that's a really deliberate ploy by Emily Maguire to get us to sort of focus on this idea of the violence within all of us, because you do start to think that there's, like, for example, the ex-husband.
Mm.
You know that he has a bit of a history, and you start to think, well, it's maybe him. And I think if you're trying to educate people about violence towards women, I think that's the theme that you've got to get across. Mm. It's like racism and all, you know, it's not, you think that, okay, that's just a little joke or that's just a little aberration, this person's done this, but those things are like the heart of the behaviours you're trying to change.
And I think that's done really well, because he's quite a complex character, Nate. He's good-hearted, and yet we know he's violent in that sort of, you know, locker room sense that this guy deserves a smack and I'm going to give him one. Mm. And he does that a couple of times. And like Chris, your sympathy tends to be with him a bit. And you think, well, the guy he's actually smacked in the mouth is so sleazy that you can almost sort of forgive him for doing it.
Mm.
And
but that's the danger, isn't
that
it?
That is. And then you think, well, gosh, if he can do that, what else can he do?
And I think she really wants to get out that message too, because I think the fact that she made the sister beautiful, you know, that was part of that idea as well, you know, that you know, she's asking for it, or, you know, she's flaunting it.
Yeah.
That sort of excuse people use for the violence within themselves.
And you also see that in the townspeople's response to the pretty young journalist. And you know, there's that scene in the bar where she walks out because she knows that they're sniggering.
Yeah.
Because one of them's come up and tried it on with her.
Mm.
And he's gone back to his mates, and, you know, and they're sort of, you can imagine the misogynistic things they're saying amongst blokes. And she flips them the bird and walks out. But you get that sense that, you know, there's this menace in male society, and it's, and Chris, the sister, she struggles with this because she likes men, like in every sense of the phrase, and yet she knows, you know, that they're dangerous.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. And I think that was good that the criminal in the end doesn't come from that set.
Yeah.
Because you start thinking that too.
Yeah.
It could be Nate, could be those guys in the bar, it could be that truck driver
the sleazy
that she takes
truck
home.
Driver. Yeah.
You know, but it's not. It's someone else, and I think that helps with that idea about the violence that's, you know, sort of inherent in our society.
Yes. And in the character of the journalist, there's a little bit of violence in her when, as a schoolgirl, she beat up the bullies, you know, who were a bit
she's
smaller
a taking
than
a prisoner
her.
Type.
Yeah. But the thing about this book, apart from, you know, that interesting discussion about or development of, you know, about male violence. This book is very much about female desire.
Mm, yeah.
Both of the main characters are women, and both of them are, dare I say, fairly highly sexed people.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting that
And both suffer for those decisions in some ways. Like they are very much in control of their own sexuality, or they like to feel like they are, but they are judged by society for those decisions that they make.
Well, they are, and both of them feel at various stages, you know, that there's a real downside to this. Like Chris, the sister of the murdered girl, she realises that she's put herself in danger because of her tendency to take men home. And May, the journalist, realises that, in fact, her sexual desire is her strongest motivating force, stronger than her ethics or her feminism or anything else. Mm. And it's really quite brutal, this book, in delving into people's sort of secret selves.
And, you know, it's an excellent segue into our discussion about journalist books, Brian.
Yes, because it is.
The character of the journalist in this book is very needy, you know, and she needs the story for the kudos it gives her and the rush of,
Not to mention the money. Yeah.
And that sort of, I don't know, that sort of ethical dilemma that journalists have about how if you get somebody to open up to you about their, innermost feelings on a sensitive issue, what do you owe them?
Yes.
You know, can you then just make that public?
Yes.
You know, that happens and so many times in society.
And I wonder if she's going to write it as an invisible author where the facts are presented as if objectively, or whether she's going to be a new journalist and insert herself in the story. And she is in the story. But anyway, I really recommend this book. Oh, the other thing, just harking back to magic realism, it's got ghosts.
Yeah. She and feels like they really haven't passed, that her sister hasn't passed yet, that she's still around and she's guiding her or making moral comments about what she's doing.
Yes, and Chris, the surviving sister, in fact, has to break the news to the spirit of her dead sister that, look, I have to tell you what's happened to you and why you're so restless. And that was quite moving too, really, wasn't it? The other sense in which the landscape itself carries the ghosts of previous atrocities.
Yeah.
The massacre of the indigenous people and then that horrible murder of the young woman in colonial days. Mm. And you do get a bit of a sense from this book that beneath the camaraderie and the sort of cheeriness of everyday life, that there's some pretty grim stuff underneath.
Yeah, but that idea, that use of the sort of ghosts, that is very familiar to what Tim Winton does. Is that the ghost is a sort of, it's like the moral loose ends that are still hanging around us as a society. The things we haven't really addressed about ourselves are they're what the ghost is reminding us of.
I'm trying to think which books Winton does that in. The Writings.
Cloud Street.
Cloud Street, Anyway, the book is An Isolated Incident by Emily Maguire. It's a crime thriller which is quite different from any crime thriller I've read.
Mm, I'm glad you liked it, Brian.
Good.
It's hard to recommend books to people.
Yes, it is. I'll just retrieve my notes and then I will hand it back to you. I love people who return books.
So do I. Good boy.
Tonight we're talking about books by journalist Lee. I think I should start perhaps by saying that in 1973, the term new journalism came into vogue. It's often attributed to Tom Wolfe, but it refers to the writing of Tom Wolfe himself, Truman Capote, Hunter S. Thompson, Norman Mailer, and others, in which the reporter takes a subjective view and abandons the traditional belief that you can present facts objectively.
Mm.
Through a sort of unmediated representation of facts. The reporter himself becomes a participant often, as Truman Capote does, as you've pointed out previously in Cold Blood. New journalism is concerned with truth as a higher priority than facts.
Yeah, or news.
Yes, and it uses the techniques of fiction. And this is all partly because some of this was based on just practice and some on literary theory, in which the traditional journalism, which purported to present the unmediated objective facts, nevertheless had assumptions and values in it anyway. So when we talk about books by journalists, some of them will adopt the more traditional approach and some will be new journalism. Well, perhaps we could start with that. Have you read anything by Tom Wolfe?
No, no. Look, my interest in the journalist genre is really, I really like, I guess what you'd say, the new journalists, but not necessarily those that are trying to impose themselves and trying to make a judgment of something. I like the ones where the person has been, because of their journalistic employment, been sent to a place that is intrinsically interesting and they've reported on it in one way while they were being employed and then reflect on it in a different way afterwards.
Yes, like a good memoir.
Yeah.
Just incidentally, I've only read one Tom Wolfe book and oddly enough, I don't think it was new journalism. It was The Right Stuff about the NASA astronauts, and it was a gripping yarn, I can tell you.
Well, that's the thing about journalists. So another part of their attraction is that their writing is so clean. That's a funny word to use to describe writing.
Yes.
More term for a household, but it's so clean and easy to read, and they can control complex ideas very well because they're very well drilled with punctuation and structure in the way they write.
Yes, and the good things about journalism, just get to the point. You know,
that's right.
No purple prose, just get there. You know,
that's right.
Sorry, I know that you have your favourites, but can I just give you an example from John Sylvester?
Yes, well, I was going to say
Andrew Brule. Yeah. John Sylvester, some of our listeners will know, writes regularly in the Melbourne Age, and this is the famous book Underbelly, The Gangland War. Three generations of Morans have knocked around in Melbourne criminal circles and their reputation was not built on pacifism. But Mark Moran, 36, had seemed to be the white sheep of the family, the one who stayed in the background and kept a low profile. However, as stock breeders will tell you, blood in the end will tell. Mark Moran was bred for trouble and it was only a matter of time before it found him. His mother, Judith Moran, was attracted to gunmen all her life. Mark's natural father was one of them. His name was Leslie John Cole, and he was ambushed and shot dead outside his Sydney home on 10th of November 1982. History repeats itself. Mark went the same way as his dad. And that's Underbelly. And the whole book's like that.
Just that paragraph, just how much he squeezed into that. Like he's got his parentage, his sort of natural inclinations, the whole history just in there. It's journalists have that ability to put the well-selected fact right where it needs to be.
Yes, and he's not just giving you the unmediated facts. I mean, he's putting his spin on it too, isn't he? And Sylvester's one of the best writers around.
Yeah,
really good.
Yeah,
those columns.
Just the use of the word "he knocked around."
Yeah,
like just picking the language that's going to suit the criminal group.
Yeah, yes. Now, perhaps more along the lines of what you were saying is Helen Garner. I always liked her earlier stuff, you know, Monkey Grip and, Other People's Children, Honour and Other People's Children, and
What's that other early one?
The Bark, the something.
Yes.
Yeah.
The children's bark.
Yeah, I really like that stuff. And Postcards from Surfers.
Yep.
Yeah, I really like that. It was something very earthy about her fiction, which, and I think people perhaps our age, you know, we're the same age as Helen Garner, basically, and it was, in a way, it was our lives she was writing about.
But she is the master of that clean prose, you know.
Yes.
Her sentences are so well constructed and easy to read. The other thing that's really journalistic about her, I think, is the way her observation of detail, you know. I've talked about this before, that recent book she published, Everywhere I Look. There's sort of little notes from her journals, and just the way she will observe somebody at a station platform, you know, behaving in a certain way.
Yes.
And she uses detail to build that word picture in your mind, and you're there. You're there with it very quickly, very cleanly.
And so evocative. You don't get the comprehensive description. You get enough to set your mind working.
Yeah.
This book, of course, The First Stone, became, a celebrated case, wasn't it? It was about a sexual harassment case at Melbourne University in which some younger women, mentored, I think we should say, by some women academics, they prosecuted this master dean, of Orman. Yes, for sexual harassment. Now, the title of this, The First Stone, is really quite interesting because I think it's fair to say that Garner makes the point in this book that while, yes, it was perhaps technically sexual harassment, it was probably just a gauche, nerdy kind of behaviour and not really a hanging offence that a person should lose a career over.
Mm.
And, of course, she was attacked ferociously by certain prominent feminists for saying, no, this is the problem. This is the problem. I mean, get away with this all the time.
Mm.
And it became such a discussion point, you know.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things that came out of that was she also had the point that these young girls were intelligent, articulate. Yeah. Why didn't they just tell him to bugger off?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
that's right.
Is that not being powerful women? Is that not where feminism should be heading? Where you just manage it?
Well, we might come back to this on another day, but she makes an interesting point for me as a male, and that is that when you're in the company of a vibrant young woman in a social setting, she has probably got more power than you have. Especially if you're a sort of fairly nerdy, old, bald, fat man. And you know,
which isn't Brian, by the way.
And so there's a certain sort of something incongruous about his being charged with harassment because technically he did harass them, but her point is that he didn't actually have much power, really. He was just a dopey guy.
Yeah.
You know.
And look, that's what makes Helen Garner such a unique writer, I think, because she takes that sort of journalistic style, a story that was in the news, it would be reported that there was this, you know, famous case, and she tries to dissect it with a journalist's sort of analytical eye and make sense of it.
And she herself, of course, becomes a big part of the story.
Yeah.
Because she tries to interview all the parties, and I think the young women refused to talk to her.
Under advice.
Advice, yes. And, of course, the book's poorer for it. There's an interesting passage in it where she goes to speak to one of the senior feminist academics, and she says, I've never been spoken to in that tone of voice since I was a little girl, you know. So she puts herself right in the story, and she's this is the great thing about Garner, is that she's constantly interrogating not only other people but herself.
Yeah, that's right. And then she does the same thing in The House of Grief. You know, why am I so interested in this? Why do I feel this sympathy for Cindy Gambino? Why do I feel this way? She's observer and of the external and also the internal, the effect that it's having on her.
Yeah. And the other one I liked, and you might notice the Helen Garner inscription in the front.
worth so much more, bro.
Autograph copy. Joe Sink's Consolation. Yeah. It's the same kind of thing. I mean, how could this happen? Yeah. This is the death of a young man at a party. How could this happen? Mm. And so she investigates, and it's a very, very sad book.
Yeah.
In a way, you kind of almost feel as sad for the perpetrators as you do for the victim.
Yeah, but I think that's true in lots of her books, that she reverses the sort of initial sympathy and creates a case for the other side, and then we'll go back to the other side. So you're constantly thinking about what are the bases on which you're making your judgments.
Yeah, the complexity of human motivation and human response to things. And I think she brings out very well one of my favourites. Lee, I've dominated with my books. You tell me about the books you like.
Well, look, I really like the ones, like I said before, where you have a journalist who has had significant working experience during historic events or in interesting places, and then they reflect on what they learnt during that time. So I've got a few that I really like. There's an Australian writer called Christopher Kremer, whose books I've really liked. In fact, when I was doing some work for this today, I realised there's one I've missed, so I've got that one on my on your agenda list for next time.
On your ever-expanding list of books to read.
So Christopher Kremer worked for the ABC and the Sydney Morning Herald, and he sort of does this style which is called narrative nonfiction or literary nonfiction, where he takes us to a place and tries to understand that culture and the way that society operates. But he uses some of the techniques of fiction to do that. So the one I'd talk about first is called The Carpet Wars. And it's basically about the 1990s in Afghanistan. And it tells a story about Najibullah and the Mujahideen and then the Taliban, etc. Mm. So it's a sort of a 10-year journey through that dysfunction in that whole Persian Empire. But it's told sort of through the structure of the carpet makers and the disruption to their trade and how what was going on changed the whole sort of structure of that society about what was valuable and how you could conduct your trade, etc. It's a really interesting background to something that is a driving force still in the world today.
Well, possibly a good example of the change that the new journalism brought, because previously a journalist would go there and you would get all the facts about, you know, the tribal warlords and the American involvement and, you know, but to get the contextual experience of an ordinary working person not known to the wider world, that I think has been one of the characteristics of this newer journalism.
And it puts human flesh on problems that we're still really reading about, and it builds a deeper understanding of the complexities, you know, in a world where there's Donald Trumps that's trying to simplify everything.
Yes.
This is the sort of flip side of that. It's trying to say, you know, you can't solve these problems with military hardware because there's some really endemic things in the society that need treatment.
The journalists all know this. It's funny that politicians never seem to get that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose they're writing retrospectively, so that might help. And another one of his that's really good is called Inhaling the Mahatma, and that's set in India. He was there from he was there in the early 90s, I think, and then he goes back in 2004. And he says things like, you know, the things that really bring it home to you about the importance of understanding this sort of society is that, you know, he says one in every six people on our planet is an Indian, you know. And yes. And how this is the world's greatest experiment in democracy.
Yes.
And to understand how that can happen in a society that's been, you know, wrenched by these sectarian differences and this terrible divide between the developing poor part and the really extreme poverty. And he marries an Indian woman, and it's sort of it talks about coming to terms with India. And, of course, the title is really funny because he's in this boat and they are actually, I think he talks about how the ashes of Gandhi were, you know, they distributed, there must have been 10 tons of it because it was distributed everywhere. And he goes out in a boat and they, you know, tip it in and, of course, with dust.
Yeah.
And he actually inhales
the Mahatma.
But it's also about sort of coming to terms with India. So they're both fantastic.
Now, the author's name again?
Christopher Kremer.
Kremer. Right. Excellent.
And another one, well, there's a couple I really like, so I'll have to be quick.
No.
Another one that sort of deals with that, you know, my experience in a interesting part of the world is and this is quite old, this one, but it was really good. Eric Campbell, who's an ABC correspondent, and his book that I read was called Absurdistan.
I love that title.
Yeah, it is quite funny. And it's about the idea of juggling, I think this is from the blurb, juggling life, love and fatherhood while reporting from some of the most dysfunctional places on earth. Eric Campbell was profoundly affected by his involvement in a suicide bombing in Iraq in 2003, where he had just gone there and he was with a cameraman and, you know, the car pulls up and he describes in great detail, you know, how that there's this sense of disbelief. He was injured but survived and his friend, the cameraman, was killed. So it's sort of about the idea of the adrenaline rush of the foreign correspondent, but it's a behind the scenes look at things like Kosovo and Chechnya and a little bit about Afghanistan. And there's some really funny things like, you know, going, he describes, you know, going to the new tourist resorts where they showed the silos where the weapons were kept during the Soviet era, and you can go and sleep in them, and the guard dresses up in his old uniform and says, "This is the button, comrade, that we would press." And you know, he's got a great sense of the absurd. So it's I really liked that, and it was very moving. His description of that exposure to real terrorism.
You've just reminded me that I think I've had a subconscious assumption that foreign correspondents that you see on the TV news are all single people.
You would think.
So does he have wife and children at home while he's dodging bombs in?
And he says that in the end, that he realises he'd gone so far down the path of that sort of adrenaline-chasing journalism that he thought it was fine to leave a wife and son at home and go off to a country that's a war zone. And that sort of really, that's a real sort of epiphany for him after that. He realises he's got to change things. And he comes back and he becomes involved in the show Foreign Correspondent, but he's Sydney-based now, I think.
I'm sure that they are a kind of breed apart from, you know, people who go off to war zones. Yeah.
But their ability to select detail, you know, it's like they can report about this bombing going off, but they had that journalistic sort of sense of, the story might be behind those people observing, you know, and how they're feeling and stuff. So that they report for the ABC and then these books come later with all that other material that they've gathered during their time.
Just while we're talking about foreign correspondence, have you read Megan Stack's Every Man in This Village?
No, no, that's a Year 12 book. I know that.
Really interesting. She's sent there by some American news agency as a relatively young reporter, and she gets there and she just talks about, you know, being in Afghanistan and Iraq and for a little while in Libya, and she just talks about the absurdity of everything, and she realises after a while that all the evidence that she gathers on the ground contradicts the official reports that she's getting. And yet, of the people on the ground, the people like the Mujahideen and so on, you can't trust them because they've got another agenda. You know, they want to get American money, so they'll fabricate things to get it.
Yep.
And then they'll take money from the Taliban, you know, as well. And in Iraq, you know, all the press releases about how well things are going, and yet, you know, his people are getting blown up everywhere, and the people on the street are saying, well, things were better in the old days under Saddam Hussein. And her conclusion is, you just can't trust anybody, least of all the Americans.
That sort of been a dilemma of the correspondent, hasn't it, since CWB?
Well, yes.
That idea of do you use what you observe and write as part of the agenda of the country you represent, or do you try and tell the truth as you can find it, and being really conscious of that fact that other people are going to want to use you for their own agendas.
Yes. We can't do justice to Bean, but of course he wrote the official history of Australia's involvement in the First World War. It took him, 30 years to write it or something. He was still working on it in the 1940s.
Had to hurry up because there was another war on the way.
But it was a massive work. I've read a couple of volumes of it, the Gallipoli stuff, and it's meticulous in its detail, and, you know, apparently cross-referenced everything, and, you know, it's meticulous. And yet, of course, he is accused, with some justification, of being a myth-maker himself, you know, of creating the Aussie stereotype and all that sort of thing.
Well, you know, it's it is a dilemma in that, you know, he was writing for an audience, and all writers want to have an effect. You know, they want to have some impact with what they write. So there's always going to be this instinct to sensationalise or glamorise or, you know. I think that's probably why I like these journalist books that they write after they're finished.
Yes.
Because then they're just providing the colour. Yeah. That they picked up. There's not that agenda.
Yes. Do you mean the reflection? Do you mean they can later on they can interrogate?
Yeah, they may well have thought those things at the time, but they didn't write about them because they had an agenda of what has happened today, not what do you think.
Yes.
You know, it's been going on over the last few months.
And isn't that an interesting thing about journalism generally, that you can watch the news on a regular basis and still not get a pattern of historical things happening, you know? I think that's true, that, you know, you see things are presented on the news in a fairly isolated sort of a way, and I think it's a great gift to be able to create a narrative out of it which...
But there
gives
must also
the reader
be,
a bit of background.
There must also be this moment where those journalists think, you know, this is absurd. Like, you know, imagine being in a country where you're reporting on famine, and you are well fed, you're healthy, you know, you're
capable of getting on a plane and getting the hell out of there.
And to be, it must be very emotionally wrenching to be in that sort of environment.
Yes. We just mentioned political journalists for a moment. Of course, the famous Woodward and Bernstein. I can't remember if I ever read all the President's Men.
They're interesting because they're like that telling a story as it's unfolding.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's not putting any sort of spin on it, really. It's letting the narrative of the event drive it.
Yes.
You know?
It's almost as if the book came out, I think, I wouldn't be certain about this, but the book came out about the time of the Watergate thing, wasn't it? So, I mean, they must have actually been writing the book as they were writing their, daily reports for the Washington Post. So it must read like, a newspaper.
Yeah. An elongated version. Because that's right. They would be producing a lot more than what they would be printing.
I'm always amazed, when somebody becomes Prime Minister, 3 weeks later the biography's on the shelves and you think, gosh, that was pretty quick work.
I'm always amazed at how the journalists, you realise after an event that the journalists, like the political journalists in Canberra, they have a life of their own. They have their jokes, they have all this insider knowledge that they don't actually share with us. Then the event will happen, like Tony Abbott gets deposed, and then the book comes straight out and everybody knows that, that was what was happening.
Have you read Nikki Savage's Road to Ruin? You absolutely must read it because it does exactly that, and it does what I don't think any other political book I've read does. It gives chapter and verse. It names names and quotes people. And it's gobsmacking. It is absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
What went on in that office, oh, my God. And that's what I was saying before. Like, you could watch all the news reports and not get that and just not know what the backbenchers are saying or what the chief of staff said to the secretary. You just don't get that on the news. But Nikki Savva got it all.
And those journalists, they're conscious of that sort of, the off-the-record stuff, if you like. Mm. And it's got a sort of statute of limitations that it eventually can just spill out.
Wow, that's what's so shocking about it, really, is that people were prepared to speak to her on the record. Mm. So the undercurrents that must go on in Canberra, gosh.
So that's sort of another whole style of the journalistic novel or text, if you like, about the one that, takes you behind the scenes of an event that's just happened and provides a sort of salacious details of what it went on.
Yes.
That's a different group again, I reckon. That's for when you're wanting to really understand a particular event and how it worked. And, journalists do that quite often with major political figures or events.
Yes. The journalists' accounts are always so much better than the politicians' memoirs, aren't they?
It's got something to do with the way they use language,
Yeah.
I mean, the politicians are sort of using that like legalese. They're not trying to get themselves in trouble with any words that they choose.
Yes. Yeah. That could be our motto, like, write as though it's going to get you into trouble. Now, I'm sorry you haven't finished. Have you read any great travel books?
Oh, yeah. I really like Eric Newby. I've read virtually everything he's ever written. You go through phases in your... I'm trying to think of some others that I've read, but,
Bill Bryson.
Yeah, no, I haven't read any Bill Bryson.
Oh, look, I'll see if... I won't try to find the extract, but his book Down Under is very, very funny because he's an expatriate American living in England and he comes to Australia and he really likes it because it's so different from both his home and his adopted home. But it's strange. Mm. He finds it strange, but likable. And he's written an entire chapter about his introduction to cricket. And his introduction to cricket is that he's driving from Sydney to Adelaide. And the only station he can get is the ABC. So he's got 2 days of cricket commentary. And he's got no idea what this cricket is. And he's so, so intrigued. When he gets to Adelaide, he goes straight to the Adelaide Oval and goes in to see what they're talking about. It's very, very funny. Anyway, I recommend Bill Bryson.
The other one I've read a lot about is Paul Theroux.
Yes.
And I was amazed to realise that Louis Theroux, who does it,
is his son.
Yeah. He was left behind when he went, you know, on his canoe trip through the Oceania and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm reading The Deep South. Well, I've started. Struggle. I've got so many books.
Yes, that's the trouble with this.
On my to read list.
I come home from this every week and think, right, I've got to start on that now and I've got this to do. And anyway.
Oh, and just to revert for a minute, speaking of political books, do you ever read Goodbye Jerusalem by Bob Ellis?
Oh, no, but there's a fantastic... download some podcasts from Richard Feidler does, you know, the Conversation Hour. And there's one that he does with Bob Ellis just before he died, which is really, really funny.
Oh, I must
he
keep
talks
an eye
about
out for
he talks about how you know, our tendency to let the most boring, loudest person in the room dominate. He's brutally honest.
He's very
irreverent.
Funny, Bob Ellis. Mm. Very funny. This is the book which notoriously had to be
pulped
because it said some unpleasant things about a former treasurer of Australia.
So you managed to this pick book, yours
yes,
out of the
that's
pulp
right.
bin.
That's right. Don't tell anybody because they'll come and get it off me. But this is the original.
Wow.
Uncensored version of Bob Ellis's Goodbye Jerusalem.
I've got a copy at home of that. I can't even remember a name now. Remember that Australian writer who faked a Holocaust story?
Demidenko. Yeah.
And that had to be
The hand that signed the paper.
Yes.
Oh, was it taken off?
Well, yeah, I think so. I don't think they recalled them or anything. Anyway,
I interrupted you, Lee. You've still got a couple of books in front of
I'll
you.
I'll just do another one that I read recently. If there's anyone out here listening, I'd like somebody to read. Peter Stefanovic's just published one called, with the most corny title imaginable, Hack in a Flak Jacket. Anyway, but it is about his experiences in Gaza, which really... I really like this. It's sort of almost a bit like historical fiction, but it's not meant to be fiction.
Oh.
But it's background reading about very complex problems told from the point of view of somebody who'd spent a bit of time there.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, frankly, commercial television journalism leaves me a bit cold.
Yeah.
Because it's so cliche-ridden.
Yeah.
So you're recommending Peter?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been. I'm calling to our many, many varied listeners out there, Brian.
Yes.
If anybody has read it,
yes, you could let
I'd
us
like
know.
Know.
I should tell people you can get in touch with us here on email. The address is onair@3abr.org. That, of course, stands for Apollo Bay Radio.org. onair@3abr.org. Yes, we will read any emails you do send in.
We want someone to read that. My last one's probably this one I read recently. It isn't, fabulously written and it doesn't cover, you know, really earth-shattering events, but it was quite enjoyable because... I will tell you who it is first. How about that? Storyteller by Zoe Daniel, a foreign correspondent memoir. Zoe Daniel, during that this book deals with her experiences as a Southeast Asian correspondent. She is now working as a Washington correspondent, so you see her often reporting on the latest hilarity of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But it was interesting because when she, in this book, she talks about that it's a situation where you are an ordinary person who finds themselves eyewitness to the extraordinary.
Yeah.
And how that becomes very addictive. But for her, having to deal with having, she wanted to have a child and she was in her mid-30s and realised, you know, her door was closing. Mm. So she went ahead and had children and then got a posting, and it was a sort of a dream posting. So she goes, but she feels like the whole time that she's half working, half parenting and not doing a good job of either.
Yeah.
And I think most women would relate to that. And she talks about the difficulties of travelling alone and using sat phones to communicate in areas where there's absolutely no other communication. Mm. And that's that sort of idea of the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
I'm reporting to people sitting back in their comfortable lounge rooms eating their dinner from places where such things are completely unknown.
Yes.
You know? And we've sort of come to expect that, don't we? We expect the journalists to be on the ground.
Yeah, we do.
Telling us. So that was quite interesting. You know, she tells a few funny stories about how, you know, in Sierra Leone, she was hearing knocking at the door at 3 a.m. and it turned out it was a giraffe eating the rooftop of her hut. So,
like a pretty interesting read.
Yeah, well, I think those sort of ones, the Australian journalists I particularly seem to like. Maybe because you see them on the telly and you know who they are, but, you know, that sort of journalism where they report on interesting places and give that sort of colour and fleshing out of the issue from a human point of view.
Lee, we're almost out of time, but discussion about books by journalists, I think we just have to mention, don't we, things like, well, I don't know if he's a journalist, but I was going to say Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed, but that was 1965 about the, the problems in the car industry.
Yeah.
And there are some books which really do change things. I was thinking another one. This is a favourite of our mutual friend, Dave Tardif. Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And that, I think that had a lot to do with changing the general public's attitude towards Indigenous Americans.
Mm.
You know, and I'm trying to think of some other groundbreaking books by journalists. Oh, Mystery Train. This is, you know, about music. It's 1975, Mystery Train was published, and it's about the music, really, of the Mississippi, going back to Robert Johnson. But it talks about the band, as in Robbie Robertson, Randy Newman, and Elvis Presley. And that became, you know, one of those really famous books that everybody either had read or wished they'd read or pretended to have read. Mystery Train. Just a travel tip for anyone listening. Carry a book. Carry a book. It's a great conversation starter.
Yes, that'd be interesting. Does a Kindle work just as well?
possibly not.
Most of my friends take Kindles when they travel now, but I like to have the physical book. I mean, the Kindle's great when you're travelling, there's no doubt about it, because you don't want to get stuck, do you, waiting for a train for 12 hours with nothing to read.
No, you have
it's
to
sort
have
of a
book.
Vision of hell, isn't it?
Absolutely have to have a book when you're travelling. And John Smith, you'll be pleased to know, prefers the paper copy and lugs books around with him, an extra bag for books. Other books that have changed everything, I suppose All the President's Men changed history a little bit, really.
Well, it opened people's eyes up to what really went on, didn't it?
And Dispatches, a book published in 1977, did so much to tell people about the Vietnam War, the things which the official news did not tell you. Written by Michael Herr, who had been a correspondent
yeah.
during the Vietnam War.
He's probably, you know, that's the genesis of some of these other ones, isn't yeah. it? Like you reported at the time, but then you had more to say later. Yeah.
Yes. The other book which was very influential was The Beauty Myth by Naomi Wolf.
Yeah.
Well, you've kind of got me started, Lou. We've only got halfway through our list and we've been going over an hour. So that was our discussion of books by journalists. Probably next week, war books. What I find interesting about Australian war books is that if you read the books that were published in 1919 and then the books that have been published more recently, profound change
yeah.
in the way the same facts are represented.
Yeah, that's right. And that's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. The way, you know, people often say that about history, how it's, you know, it's a tale told by the people of the time and reflecting their interests rather than
yes.
the time they're writing about. Because the way people write about the war, and it's changed so much.
Yes. Yes, it has. And it's gone through distinct phases, I think.
Mm.
More about that
yes.
next week. Thank That's you for your company. Day. Thank you for Emily Maguire's An Isolated Incident. This has been The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. Hope to catch you next time. Good night.
Good night.